podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
On Florida's Space Coast, we think you can have the best of both worlds. Kind of like right now. Driving at your desk, maybe at the gym, but you're also grooving to some music. Visit us and you'll go to the beach and see a rocket launch or go kayaking and manatee spotting. It's all waiting for you on the only beach that doubles as a launch pad. Plan your adventure today at visitspacecoast.com.
Well, I couldn't keep away. I just love talking cricket. Welcome back to Cricket Unfiltered. I'm Menas. I'm joined by my co-host, Paul. How are you, Paul?
Good, Menas. It's great that we've decided to spend our hiatus from doing podcasts by doing some podcasts.
Yeah, I've just found myself the last 2 weeks watching a lot of cricket, you know, not just test matches and ODIs, but T20 blasts and all sorts of stuff. So I just can't keep away from the game I love. And, you know, with the test series against Sri Lanka starting this week, I thought it'd be the perfect time to just jump in. There's been some big news in Australian cricket concerning David Warner and the Big Bash, and then, you know, look ahead at what should be a really interesting two tests against Sri Lanka in Gaul. You know, a lot to look forward to, Paul.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the test series immensely. I have been quite strategic in the last few weeks, not watching as much of the T20s and 50-over games as I've done for a very, very long time. But that's partially because I really I want to try to watch every ball of the test series, which is going to be quite interesting, juggling a few other commitments. But it was good to sort of freshen up. I still followed them. I watched bits and I've read about them. But, it's been a long, long time since I've kind of had a little bit of a break from following the Australian team. And I'm, really, really keen for the test series. I think it's going to be fascinating. 2016 was fascinating. I think this one's going to be just as good.
Yeah, I agree. Before we get into the stuff in Sri Lanka, just two bits of news that's more domestic, that David Warner's leadership ban within Australian cricket looks set to be discussed at the next Australian Cricket Board meeting. And I think that's very interesting that they're going to revisit his leadership ban.
I think it's the right thing. I mean, I think that what he did was really bad and he deserved a strong punishment for it. I think if you draw a line through the level of punishment that he got, then it is a bit excessive. I mean, to be banned for life from leadership after being banned for a year from the game and all of the indirect huge financial ramifications and everything that he went with. I mean, if he'd done something really genuinely deplorable, like smack someone over the head with a bat, what's he going to do? Get the death sentence? I think it's the right time to revisit that and say he's been banned for a long time from a leadership position. I think he definitely is in the conversation for our next white ball leader. So from a pragmatic point of view, I think it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I agree. And perhaps, you know, through the passage of time, maybe a little bit more credence is given to the fact that David Warner was under immense pressure. And, you know, what was happening to his wife off the field with, I don't even want to talk about it, but what the South African fans were doing to Candace Warner. I think as time has gone on, I think people have I have been a bit more sympathetic to the fact that Warner was probably under, you know, immense emotional pressure at the time, and that maybe wasn't taken into account when dishing out a life ban.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And but I also think that his behaviour since then, he's quite a good role model now, and the way that he, you know, comports himself, and he's been very good since then. And I think, yeah, he's made a mistake. He's paid a very hefty price for it. And I don't think it's in any. I don't think it's in anyone's interest for the ban to be continued.
Yeah, you know, and I guess the main reason they're doing it is to try and induce him to play back in the Big Bash because he said he's not going to play. So that's one reason. But if something were to happen to Aaron Finch, say he were to get injured ahead of the T20 World Cup in Australia later this year, David Warner would be a natural fit to take over the leadership. He's probably our most experienced T20 skipper.
I agree. And I think that, Cummins is the other choice, but I kind of like Cummins being captain of the test side only at this point rather than lumping him with everything. There's still questions of if he's always in our best T20 11 as well, depending on certain conditions. So I'd be more than happy for Warner to be the captain, and I think that the energy, you could just imagine the passion that he'd bring to it, and I think that'd be a good thing.
Yeah, it's very divisive though. As soon as the news came out about Warner, there were people online who were saying that he should never be allowed in a leadership position again, and there are hardliners when it comes to Sandpapergate that will just never, I don't know, see the shades in the story. It's so black or white for them, and I think there will be a section of the fans who wouldn't be happy if Warner was Australian captain.
Yeah, and look, I can understand that, and I'm not diminishing how disappointed and horrified I was at the whole affair. I just hope that the people who are, never happy to see him captain again, and who, the same people who might be very happy for him and Smith to have never been allowed to be back, do they follow that same form for all things? That, if you're going to be that harsh on them, then, the only logical conclusion is that Ben Stokes should never have been allowed to play cricket again, given what he did was 100 times worse than what Warner did. Yet I don't think that's the case. I'm happy for Ben Stokes to play cricket and happy for him to be captain of England. I think that it's a sense of proportionality. And if you're going to demand the very biggest punishment to Smith and Warner, then I hope that you're consistent with that in other things and demand very, very big punishments for lots of things.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, athletes make their mistakes in a public for the public to see, whereas most people make their own mistakes, but it's not on a public stage. So look, that's been a talking point, so we'll see if that does get revisited. And as I said, there's a move to try and get more Australian stars in the Big Bash. There's also been an announcement that they're going to have a BBL draft for overseas players, so a Big Bash draft. Paul, I mean, the structure of the draft, they're sort of, I guess, they're putting them in different levels, the international players, aren't they?
Yeah, so it's kind of, you can nominate to be gold, you can nominate to be gold and silver, or you can nominate to be gold, silver and bronze. And what they're basically expecting is that the salaries will be 260K Aussie for gold, 175K for silver and 100K for bronze. And then there's also Cricket Australia will elevate players that they believe are superstars to a platinum level where you'll get paid 340K. So the different levels, it's kind of a little bit analogous to the BBL, to the IPL, where you can set your reserve. So if you say, look, I'm only interested in gold, I don't want to come for less than that, and if that means that I therefore don't get picked up, well, so be it. And that's what you do with the IPL when you say, I'm going to put myself at the highest reserve, and if I therefore never get a bid, well, I'm comfortable with that. Other players who are just desperate to come might put themselves at gold, silver, bronze, and they're happy to get whatever they can get. So on that side of things, it sounds probably unnecessarily complex, but I can see why they've done it, and I don't think it's too bad an idea.
And in that top platinum level, Cricket Australia is going to top up the money, aren't they, to try and get some really big stars?
Yeah, well, I think Cricket Australia is going to top up the money for all levels, but much more so at the platinum level. So the platinum level, they're saying that the players can expect to earn about $340,000. And Cricket Australia is going to be putting in a fair degree of that. So of the overall commitment that clubs need to have at the draft. So in the draft, you have to purchase two players or three. You've got a choice of that. And it has to be one at that in the sort of platinum or gold level. So what I think the best thing about the draft is, not so much that the draft itself will be a TV spectacle and the talking points and all that's all good. I think the best thing is that it signifies that Cricket Australia are determined to try to get better overseas players, that they're willing to pay to do so, and it's not going to be up to the clubs to ruin their own salary cap in order to do so. The salary cap's only $1.9 million. So clubs previously would naturally have been fairly reluctant to try to offer too much. But now I think if you're a superstar, 340K, and it's important to note, it's for how long you want to play. So if you only nominate for, say, half the tournament, you'll get paid 340K for half the tournament. Now, the clubs might decide that because that's not long enough, they don't want to pick you up. That's the risk that the player runs. But I think it does put us at least in an ability to compete with these other leagues, that you might say, well, what would you rather? 340K is a pretty healthy whack of money for 5 weeks' work. You might be able to get more at the new India-backed South African league or in the UAE league or the Bangladesh league. But Australia in summer, you know, it's the premium cricketing countries, you know, in terms of the history of the game. It's a wonderful place to be in summer. The lifestyle would play a part. I think at least gives us a chance to compete with for some of those big names.
Yeah, I agree with all those points. I also think that it'll mean that there's a sort of a better distribution of talent across the league. Some teams have done really well recruiting overseas stars. Some teams haven't done as well, and maybe that's to do with the budget stuff you mentioned there. But this will ensure that I think there's a better distribution across the league. I don't think it solves all the problems that the Big Bash is facing in terms of talent. I think getting the Australian players back is probably more important because I don't even think the international talent we've been getting is particularly weak. It's just that the Australian talent's not there. So if they can get the Australian talent in there, and that could happen because the one-day games that are scheduled to play against South Africa look like they won't go ahead, then you add the sort of the draft in with, you know, your players like Maxwell and Stoinis and Zampa and all those big names, Smith playing in the Big Bash, we could actually have a pretty good summer.
Absolutely. I agree with you. This is a good little bit. The more than little, it's a good piece of the puzzle, but the big piece of the puzzle is getting the Australian players back. And I think that Cricket Australia's mindset was that this year, if they were forced to go ahead with those South African one-dayers, that was going to be the last year. That from then on, it was going to be after the Sydney Test match, the decks are cleared and all the Australian players will be available for the Big Bash and heavily encouraged to participate in it. If this South Africa series does get cancelled, then that's just going to be brought forward a year. And I think that is a massive, massive change. The notion that once that 7th of January is finished and the Sydney Test match is over, that you can tune in to the Big Bash and you can see not just Maxwell and Stoinis and Zampa and the sort of the white ball players, but those Test players as well who haven't really been part of it. If you know, if Smith's playing regularly and Cummins is playing regularly and Warner's playing regularly, then it really does elevate the league. And I think that's a massive step in the right direction.
One issue, though, that could be concerning is, say, for example, Chris Lynn. He's out of contract he wasn't given a contract by Brisbane Heat, so he's out of contract. He doesn't have a Big Bash contract. Chris Lynn could get offered a lot of money to go and play in these other overseas T20 leagues, and we could see some of our talent actually not playing in the Big Bash. I mean, Chris Lynn has been carving it up in the T20 Blast. He's the leading run scorer. Well, he was a couple of nights ago, and he scored two centuries, a couple of 50s as well. He'll be in demand by these overseas leagues. So it's not good if our best talent's going overseas.
Yeah, that's a really good point. But I think that's something that maybe they'll be able to address. Let's assume that this year goes ahead after the Sydney Test, all the players are available and the draft goes pretty well. But someone like Lynn does get poached by one of these other leagues. Maybe then they can say, right, in the future, we also need some sort of way of keeping the best Australian players here as well. Some sort of Cricket Australia top up to, you know, maybe they need to sort of deem a couple of Australian, or not a couple, but a handful of Australian players are at the platinum level, and that they will therefore pay them extra. But I'm sure also they'll be applying a degree of soft pressure, which might not apply so much to Lynn because he's almost at the point now where he is a free agent, but to, you know, you hinted it with Warner that they're going to find a way to make him be in consideration for captaincy again. They'll probably be pointing out to the Australian players, look, we really do want you to stick around here rather than going off to one of these other leagues, and we'll be very much more charitably disposed towards you in the future.
Yeah, a player like Tim David is another one. I mean, he's getting paid a fortune to play in the IPL. He's another player that could be offered vast amounts of money to go and be a sort of headline act in some of these overseas leagues. But I guess they could apply a bit of pressure with him if he wants to sort of play for the Australian side.
I mean, regular listeners to this show will realize that my love for Tim David has just come from nowhere. It now eclipses almost anything else in my life. That I'd be happy for them to have a Tim David level that only applies to Tim David and just pay him $2 million to play in this.
Excellent. Well, that's sort of the main bits of cricket news. So let's sort of look at the Sri Lankan tour. So Australia won the T20 series 2-1, and they lost the five-match ODI series 3-2. So a pretty good performance from Australia, you know, winning one and losing one series. I mean, I know you didn't watch a lot of it, but, you know, some of my general takeaways were, you know, it's been well publicised. A lot of injuries have affected the Australian side. So it was pretty hard to get a read on, I guess, the overall form of the white ball sides, because a lot of players were coming in and out. Stark was injured. Stoinis was injured. Agar was injured. Marsh came in and out. Head came in and out. Kane Richardson went home. So it's been, you know, come and set out a game. So it's been very hard to get a read on the form of the side. But by the end of it, you could see that the Sri Lankans were going back to their tried and tested method of beating Australia, which is produce absolute Bunsen burners, pitches that turn from ball one, and just see how we do. And, you know, that's a real indication of what we'll see in the two tests at Gaul.
Big time. And as much as I don't agree that that's what sides should do, it does make for highly watchable test cricket, that you can't take your eyes away from matches like that. And I just think it's wonderful that we've had these white ball games before the test series. I remember in 2016, we actually won the white ball series over there. And, you know, maybe they didn't quite prepare. I think the pitches were nowhere near as turning. They're probably just kind of keen to produce white ball pitches that were producing attractive cricket. But I think the fact that there's been, you know, some of those highlights of players being beaten all ends up by balls turning absolutely square and then the next one goes straight on, it's a very difficult thing to get used to. So at least that we've had those white ball experiences to get a little bit better at that. Whether we'll be good enough, I'm not sure. But I do think we've got to pick our side based on there's no point picking a traditional side for the first test and then sort of realizing afterwards that we needed to be a little bit more prepared to adapt to the conditions. Like if we go in with three quicks or something like that, and we'll be doing demonstrably the wrong thing. We've got to be aggressive right from the start with our selection, I think.
Yeah, I agree. As you say, it's good that the white ball stuff was before the test. I mean, David Warner got plenty of time out in the middle. Manus Labuschagne spent a bit of time out there during the ODI series. Glenn Maxwell scored a match-winning 81 in the 81 not out in the ODIs, and he's been included in the test squad. Which how happy were you when that news came out?
Oh, I mean, I've said it before that they just keep on dangling the carrot for me that one day he's going to get back in the side. And I think this is going to be it, surely, that he's got to be picked in the 11. They're not that stupid as to not pick him. I mean, he'd be still one of the first players I'd pick in the side in those conditions, not for anything else, but for his bowling. That I was listening to Gilchrist on Waitley just before we've done this show, and he was talking about the time that he was over there when it might have been 99, maybe when Sri Lanka went in with basically only Chaminda Vass as the quick bowler. And he said by the end, even he was bowling spin. And that's what you need, that Maxwell's spin bowling. I could see him bowling quite a few overs. And, you know, for me, he's a compulsory inclusion.
Well, I guess it all depends on how Head's fitness goes. But would you pick Maxwell ahead of Cameron Green if Head is fit?
I'd pick Maxwell ahead of Head and Green. And I find it bizarre that that's not just as an assumption, that why would you want Head to be ahead of Maxwell in a subcontinental conditions just because he has been the incumbent in the Australian side in our conditions in summer and done fabulously well. I see a long future for Travis Head on the Australian side. I'm not saying I wouldn't pick him, but when he walks out to bat and Australia is in the midst of a potential collapse, who's going to inspire more confidence in you, Maxwell or Head? And although Head does bowl some half-decent off-spin. Maxwell's a far better off-spin bowler. So for me, Maxwell is above both Head and Green, but I'm not opposed to either of those being in the side either.
Yeah. Yeah, Maxwell was drafted into the squad. Also, three spinners are staying back, Matt Coonan and Todd Murphy and John Holland, because Ashton Agar has been ruled out of the first test. So I guess, do you want to look at the possible Australian Test 11? I mean,
yeah.
The top four seems pretty clear. You got Warner and Khawaja opening, which I actually think is probably one of the best opening partnerships we've taken to the subcontinent in a long, long time.
Agree strongly.
And then Manus Labuschagne at three, Steve Smith at four, but he's recovering from a quad injury. He missed the back half of the white ball games, but I think he'll come up for the test. I think they're just being very careful because they know he's our best player of spin.
I think that's not only our best two, numbers one and two in a subcontinental tour for a while. I know it's the same one that they had in Pakistan, but I think that top four, when you compare it to top fours that we've had in tours of Sri Lanka in the past, I'm pretty happy with this one.
Yeah, and Manus looked okay in the 50-over stuff. He showed enough to me that I think he's got the tools to cope with the ball turning and the slower conditions. I mean, he's very quick on his feet. He plays with his hands. He doesn't just sort of lunge at the ball. So I think he's equipped. But it is probably his first big test in turning conditions. He's only played in the UAE and Pakistan where the ball didn't turn. So we'll really get to see what he might be able to do in this tour and then looking ahead to India.
Well, it's a really good point. Ponting talks about his first tour of India where he just failed completely. And ever after that, though, he actually did quite well in the subcontinent. And they were talking about, oh, your record in India is not so good. And he said, well, the first tour was diabolical. After that, I did get better. So hopefully these one-dayers have started to do that for Labuschagne. And even looking ahead, even if he doesn't have a barnstorming test series, it's going to serve him well for the admittedly much more significant tour of India that we've got in February and March, where hopefully by then his ability to play in the subcontinent is really honed.
Mm. And then number five. So this is where there's, you know, if Travis Head is fit, I think they'll probably play him at five. He's got that hamstring injury. And then maybe if he's not fit, Maxwell would come in. I know what you'd do, but that's the way I think the selectors are going. I don't think Head will be fit. I think Maxwell will play. I mean, the match starts Wednesday. So I think Maxwell will probably come in there and they might move Alex Carey up to five because he's a left-hander to try and split up all the right-handers in the middle. But I'd like to see Maxwell in there instead of Head.
Well, let's just assume that's how it pans out, that Head doesn't come back from injury and Maxwell goes in. And so putting Maxwell just nominally for five, just for the sake of my head, that he goes at five. If we assume that they pick Green at six and Carey at seven, I know that's not necessarily what they'll do. The interesting thing is, what are they going to do about the fast bowlers? And it depends on how the pitch looks. I remember in 2016, Stark was effective with the new ball and got a little bit of reverse swing. If we do have Cameron Green in there as well, we've got that seam up option. Everyone's going to disagree with me on this, but maybe Cummins should show great leadership and say maybe he's not in the best 11 and that we need extra spinners or extra batters and that he should sit out.
Well, that's a great point, because if they play three spinners, which they've talked about, so say they play Lyon, Swepson, and then say Kuhneman or Holland, you know, Stark or Cummins would have to miss out. And Stark is probably a better option in those conditions.
And I know that there's no chance of that happening, and that the notion is that Cummins should never sit out because he's the captain and therefore he must be in the side. And I'm not especially bothered because I think he's such a fantastic bowler, he may well do better than Stark anyway. It just irritates me that it wouldn't even be countenanced because of this, you know, misguided belief that the captaincy is more important than actual picking the best 11 for the side. But I just think it would be wrong to go in with two fast bowlers, I think, given that they were already going to probably have Green in there as well. And it would be a great disappointment if at the end of the test match, let's revisit this at the end of that first test, and if they do pick those two quicks and we look and see, oh, Stark, 12 overs, 1 for 36 in the first innings. Cummins, 10 overs, none for 32. And in the second innings, they barely bowled at all. Then we'll say, look, you know, why do they go with both of them? Even pick another batter. If they're not going to get a bowl, then don't pick them.
I guess if they didn't pick Green, they could pick an extra bowler maybe. But, yeah, no, I think Green's a good option as the seam up and bring something with the bat. Alex Carey batted well in the 50-over stuff, so that gives you a bit of depth in the batting. And then Lyon will play. Stark should be recovered from his finger injury. And then, look, I don't think they're going to pick three spinners in the first match. I think you'll see Stark, Cummins, Lyon, and then you'll probably see Swepson, Kuhneman or Holland, one of those three. It seems like they're pretty set on playing a left-arm finger spinner. So Matt Kuhneman made his debut in the ODI series, looked pretty good. But I know Andrew McDonald would have coached John Holland at Victoria, and he'll have a lot of faith in his ability to bowl overs in those conditions. Holland, I think, played in the last tour of Sri Lanka. He was flown over there. Was that right? He was flown over on one tour, and I think it might have been Sri Lanka. So he's got experience in those conditions. So I've given you a lot there, listeners. None are very decisive. But I think they'll go Lyon. Do you think they should stick with Swepson or look at, say, Kuhneman or Holland?
They have to have a left-arm orthodox, in my opinion. And, I'm still tormented by Herath's performance in 2016 of just that you bowl left-arm round the wicket, the ball is fizzing in at middle and off, some spin and some go straight through, and it's just so difficult to play. So I certainly favour the left-arm orthodox over Swepson. I'm not completely opposed to the idea of Swepson being in there. Not convinced about Holland. His first class record, I'm just looking it up, he only averages 33. I know playing in Australian conditions, it's not necessarily the easiest spot to do well, but he hasn't really performed in the test matches that he's been given a chance in. He's been disappointing. So I haven't seen much of Kuhneman, but I think I'd favor him over Holland.
Yeah, from what I've seen, I haven't seen a lot between them. I'd probably give Holland a go, just because I think he's a bit of an old pro, and that sort of experience he had. I'd probably just favour Holland. Although Kuhneman was impressive in the white ball stuff, but I just think Holland's a bit cagey, and he's been on this podcast a couple of times, so I got to back him in.
Well, let's just have a look. Kuhneman has, he averages 34 in first class cricket with the ball, so nothing all that special there. Although he's only played the 11 games. Thing is, Kuhneman's batting average is better as well. He averages 24.5 with the bat. And, if they're line ball, then I think that's enough to get him over the line for me, given that, Holland with the bat's only averaging 14.
Yeah. So, well, that's interesting. I think Australia will go two spinners, say Lyon and one of the tweakers, then Stark, Cummins, and then Green, the all-rounder, and then Labuschagne and either Maxwell or Head to bowl overs. I agree with you. They should look at three spinners. But I do think Stark and Cummins could do damage with the new ball against the Sri Lankan top order. It's not that strong. So I think, we could benefit from having two quicks going at them for the first 15 overs. Maybe they're three for, because I think we'll find it hard. I think they'll play our spinners pretty well in their conditions.
Yeah, I'm not saying not to pick two quicks, but I think you've got to look at the pitch, and if it is looking diabolical, as to quote what Warner said about the 2016 pitches, you do get to the point where you wonder why they bowl the fast bowlers at all. And if you argue, well, with Maxwell, with Lyon, with another spinner, that you've already got enough spinning options and you don't need another one, pick another batter. Like, there's nothing wrong with just saying, let's go long with the batting, because that's where we've always struggled over there. We don't get enough runs. So I have no problem with that at all.
Yep. And so Kusal Mendes, the Sri Lankan player, said to Aaron Finch after the ODIs that, don't worry. I think they were laughing about the pitches turning, and Mendes said that they'll be the same pitches for the test match, don't you worry. So Australia's going to have to face a lot of spin bowling. I mean, Sri Lanka have two good quicks in Rajitha and Asitha Fernando, two very good quicks with the new ball. And then they've brought in Van der Say, the leg spinner from the ODI side. And then they've got Ramesh Mendes, Praveen Jayawikrama, and Lasith Embuldenia. Yes.
He did really well against England a couple of years ago. He's a good bowler.
So I think Australia's just going to be facing – we're going to be up against three spinners, and it's going to be a minefield for our batters. The ball's going to be turning from day one. Do you think Australia can muster up the skills to match Sri Lanka this time at home?
I reckon that they'll do better than they did last time. I mean, last time it didn't help that all three matches Sri Lanka got to bat first. I think we are a much better side than we were then. I think we're a sort of a smarter side as well. We'll adjust to the conditions better. I don't think Sri Lanka are as good. And I sometimes think as well that if Sri Lanka go too far and produce pitches that are spinning so much, they can run the risk of actually diluting their own home ground advantage. That's what happened. Remember that first test match in India in 2017 at Pune, where it was spinning so viciously that the Australian spinners were just as dangerous as the Indian spinners. You can go too far, and then it becomes, if Glenn Maxwell is starting to spin at 3 feet, then it becomes a bit more of a lottery, and then I'd start to favour Australia. So I think Sri Lanka need to be careful and not doctor it too much.
It's true. Sri Lanka get a bit of batting talent back as well. Angelo Matthews, the veteran all round, the ex-captain, comes back into the side, and Dinesh Chandimal, the wicketkeeper and batter who didn't keep last time for Sri Lanka, but they're two accomplished batters. So, yeah, I think let's get to some questions. We've got a question from Sam. So he wants our series predictions. So what's your series prediction for the test series? I'm going 2-0 Sri Lanka.
Funny, last time on this show I did 3-0 Australia, and then I ended up having money on Sri Lanka before each of the matches and had a lovely financial success. I don't know what I'm going to do this time, but I'm going to go, I don't know. I'll go 2-0 Australia.
I like it. And then so Sam has asked us for Smithy's average and how many centuries
in this series.
Yep.
I want to say high and lots. I don't feel I can, though. I'm not as confident about Smith as I once was, especially when he's under a slight injury cloud. He's always still the one I cheer on most, so I hope I'm wrong, but I'm going to say an average in the 30s with no centuries.
Ooh. Smithy's going to break his drought for me, so I think he's going to score 100. He had a terrible time last time in Sri Lanka. He was the skipper. He lost his rag a few times. So I think he's going to score a ton. I think he'll average over 50. Sam has asked us for Marnus. I don't think Marnus will score a century. I think Marnus will battle away and get lots of 30s and 40s, but I don't think he'll score the big one.
Yeah, I think you're right. He always seems to find a way, doesn't he? He'll get dropped three times and make 70 and just, he's quality. So, yeah, I think Marnus will average in the 40s and no centuries.
Who do you think will be the leading wicket taker for Australia in the series?
Tim David. Oh, no, sorry. I think – tell you what, I'd like to say one of the left-arm orthodoxes. If Agar had been playing, I would have said Agar. But without him there and you're not sure who they're going to pick, I suppose the safe bet is Lyon. So I suppose if I had to put my life on the line, I'd say Lyon.
Yeah, I agree, Lyon or Stark for me. Martin Lawrence has asked, how many spinners will Australia need? Well, I think they'll go conservative for the first test match, Martin, and just pick two. But the wicket for the second test could be even more spin friendly, in which case I think Australia should look at three and just see it as experience as well for them heading into more tours of the subcontinent.
I think you're probably right. I think they probably will go in the first test with Lyon. I think they will go with the left-arm orthodox, whether it's Kuhneman or Holland. And Maxwell, I think, will probably play where, and I think his bowling will go well. I hope they give him enough overs because I could see him taking a few wickets too. And, of course, you've got Labuschagne there, who is not bad either.
Yeah, Maxwell was saying in an interview after the ODIs that he's been doing a lot of bowling in the nets during the IPL with Shree, the Australian spin bowling coach who was over with him in the IPL. And he was bowling a lot, he said, and he feels very confident with the ball at the moment. So you're right, be good to have him in there for his bowling skills.
And not to just put him on for an over before tea, like to say, we're going to give you a few extended spells. You're going to have an actual, we don't expect you to take 10 wickets, but we're going to give you a chance to bowl some serious overs.
All right, so that was our preview of the Sri Lankan series. Let's end this podcast the way we end all our Cricket Unfiltered with Can't Let It Go, that little bit of cricket news that you can't let go of. Paul, what's yours?
Ah, what a glorious few test matches it's been with the English attitude. And I've always said that the whole notion of, oh, you know, test cricket, you got to put your shots away and bat time and grind it out, and you got to place that premium on your wicket. I've always said, usually that's the wrong thing to do. And it's been a delight that England have once again emphasized how true that is. Not only is it the right thing to do to play aggressively because it's more fun for everyone to watch and it's an entertainment vehicle, it's actually the right thing to do from a pragmatic point of view to try to win games. That it's so telling that game that England beat New Zealand where they had no right to do so, and Bairstow especially and Stokes came out swinging, you contrast that with the game a year before when England had a very chaseable total and they didn't even try to chase it against New Zealand. And I think that demonstrates that if you play with judicious, intelligent aggression, then you're more likely to be successful than if you play in a boring, old-fashioned boycott way. And it's wonderful when pragmatism meets beauty and that they both do the same thing.
Yeah, I turned the cricket off as Bairstow walked out to the crease that night, thinking there is no way England can win this. They're not going to score, you know, 250-odd in, you know, a session and a half, and they did it with an hour to spare. So they made a fool of me. That was incredible, incredible night. My Can't Let It Go was, I mean, this is too nice to the English, so I don't know if we can delete all this or something. Maybe we'll have to do some work in post-production. But England were playing the Netherlands in Amstelveen. I've seen cricket there. And then I went to sleep and the game had started and woke up the next day and I opened my phone and I'm seeing England 498. And I think my eyes aren't working. I'm trying to focus properly. And then when I wiped the sleep out of my eyes, I saw England had careered to 498 in 50 overs, the highest ever score in a 50-over innings, too short of 500, obviously. And one thing that makes me happy is it's gone past the record where Australia conceded 481 against England in 2019. But just phenomenal. Josh Butler, 162 off 70 balls. I know it's a small ground in Amstelveen. I've seen Australia play there in the 90s, but still just phenomenal.
2018, I think, not 2019, we conceded that. It was a five match series over there.
That's right, yeah.
5-0. When that the old Billy Birmingham one where Australia played Sri Lanka and Australia got 3 for 560 or whatever it was in the 50 overs. And I remember at the time it was so funny because it was just so idiotically,
impossible.
Never going to happen. We're on the verge of that happening now. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, well, we won't be that nice to the English again. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Cricket Unfiltered. Paul, great to catch up and chat about the test series. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And
yeah, and hopefully it's played in the same spirit as the these matches. I know that Sri Lanka is going through a very difficult time at the moment, and people are really struggling over there. So our best wishes to everyone in Sri Lanka. And it was lovely seeing the crowd really warming to the Aussies after the series, and that on the heels of the Pakistan series, it was so well received as well. It is so nice to have the Australian team playing in the gracious way that we, you know, the history books say we used to play all the way back in those in the distant past. It's wonderful to see it happening again. You know, credit once again to the Aussies for playing the game in the right spirit.
Absolutely. And look, credit to the Aussies for going. They've gone to Pakistan under strict security. They're now in Sri Lanka. And it's nice to see the team on the road again. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll be back, I guess, in about a month's time. Taking a break now, and then we'll be back at the end of next month.
See you, everyone.
On Florida's Space Coast, we think you can have the best of both worlds. Kind of like right now. Driving at your desk, maybe at the gym, but you're also grooving to some music. Visit us and you'll go to the beach and see a rocket launch or go kayaking and manatee spotting. It's all waiting for you on the only beach that doubles as a launch pad. Plan your adventure today at visitspacecoast.com.
Sports Social Podcast Network.